Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In 2018, my guest polled Americans on how much time they spent on political activity, and he found that about a third of Americans said they spent 2 hours or more on that activity. But nearly all of that time was spent consuming political news or talking about what's wrong or right with politics with like-minded others in person or on social media, not real political activity. Political scientist Eitan Hirsch calls that political hobbyism, something he readily admits that he does himself. But in his new book, Politics is for Power, the associate professor of political science at Tufts University shares stories of those who took the next step beyond political hobbyism and moved to direct advocacy and organizing, and was amazed by the difference they're making in their local communities, winning elections, and changing policies in places like Western North Carolina, Western Pennsylvania, or the Boston suburbs. And he imagines what politics might be like and how they might be more interesting and less frustrating if more of that group of political hobbyists became grassroots activists. Hirsch is the author of Hacking the Electorate, and his new book is titled Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. It's published by Scribner. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Eitan Hirsch, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you mean by politics is for power?
You know, I just mean that politics is about, you know, working with others with goals and strategies to influence the government, and that means getting other people to take actions they wouldn't otherwise take, you know, neighbors to vote or politicians to vote on policy. You got to move people somehow. That's what power is all about. And as I talk about in the book, that's just not the experience that most people are having when they're engaging in politics today.
And it wasn't necessarily always the case. I think when you look back 50 years ago, certainly before the internet, probably before television, this sort of grassroots involvement in your neighborhoods, in your immediate areas, to convince people to participate in the political process was perhaps more far-reaching?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a general sense, say, 50 years ago, particularly among college-educated people, that they were stewards of their communities. They were responsible for what was going on. And if there was some big issue, it was on them to solve it. And I think as we've had this decline of civic institutions and really an increase in the number of people who are, you know, well-educated, we've had this change, which is that most people now don't feel like they are stewards of a community. They don't feel like they're important. They want to follow important information. They want to know the news, but they themselves don't feel like they're an important part of solving any problems.
Is that because life is complex? There's a lot of things going on in our lives. I'm going to leave it to others?
Probably that's life has gotten simpler. You know, we haven't had military conscription in 50 years. People who have a college degree are doing very well, particularly, you know, that's why you see this behavior, particularly among college-educated white people, of spending hours a day consumed with news but not doing anything real.
And of course, in your book, you, as a political scientist, you look at polling data about voting, and anytime the idea of voting is on a political poll, it's sky high. It is my duty to vote. I appreciate my right to vote, 90%. And even things like local elections. I want to participate in local elections. I think it's very important, you know, from school board to city council. And yet voting rates are abysmal for those sorts of elections.
People lie through their teeth about voting, particularly at local levels. I mean, we know voting is like 10% sometimes in these local contests, but everyone feels like if they're asked about it, they're supposed to say they voted.
Well, one of the things you write about, and it's a subtitle of your book, it says, most people who follow politics closely today are what you call political hobbyists. What do you mean by that?
Yes, you know, if you look at all the data, all the ways people are spending time on politics today, you sum it up. You know, it's news consumption, it's debating online, it's sharing things, it's, you know, sometimes token actions like signing an online petition. It's a lot of worrying and anxiety about politics. But that doesn't, again, that doesn't really sound like politics, like working with others with goals and strategies to influence the government. It looks more like something people are doing for their own intellectual and emotional gratification. It sounds a lot more like, you know, what people are doing when they're engaging in sports than it does sound like a form of power seeking. And, you know, it's an insult to call it political hobbyism because people have such strong emotions to it. And I get that. You know, I come from the world of the political hobbyists. I'm among them, and I understand it. And the goal of the book is really to see if people can change their behavior so that, you know, their actions are more reflective of the deep concern that they have for the country.
And I guess perhaps one of the big symptoms of being a political hobbyist is if you are engaged about the issues of the day, you're only speaking to like minds, as opposed to persuading or engaging with people of not like minds.
That's right. And it's not just like Democrat versus Republican. You know, if you care about some issue, you know, like a lot of Democrats care about climate change, for example. Now, if you wanted to actually move politics on that issue, you'd have to encounter people in your own community who maybe they vote the same way that you do at the presidential level. But now you're going to have to ask them to make some action that will affect their own economic standing or their home values or stuff like that. And the conversations are much harder. Real politics is both more interesting, and it's not as simple as just, you know, there's some evil bad guy over there on the other side.
One of the things you write about is people who are actually involved in deep canvassing. And this was something that I think used to happen a generation ago, where a person got deeply involved in an issue or for a candidate or for a party and would take on all comers, not necessarily in an adversarial way, but in an engagement way of trying to persuade people in their neighborhood, even strangers, to be persuaded to their point of view. Today, even when that happens, it's very much perfunctory, it's scripted, it's not genuine. And you began following some people who are doing this deep canvassing. What did you learn from that?
Yeah, you know, I learned that politics is more like real life than I thought it was. You know, it's like if you need to convince someone to do something that they wouldn't want to do, you know, whether that's someone at work or maybe a child of yours, you know, you don't just yell at them. You don't just be an antagonist. You have to be empathetic. You have to understand where they are coming from. You have to be a listener. We all know this. But somehow when it comes to politics, we're either in this mode of like, you know, yelling or, you know, when face to face in like a canvas setting, we do something like very weird and scripted. I mean, anyone who's been canvassing or been the recipient probably knows there's like a 2-minute script and it says, here's why you should vote for this person. It's a talking conversation, not a listening one. And so these folks who are engaged in deep canvassing, they, you know, they go to doors of their opponents and they treat them, you know, more like a friend than a stranger. And they say, hey, here's where I'm coming from on these issues or these political concerns. And they tell some intimate story about themselves. And then they focus on listening and looking the person in the eye and saying, like, where do you come from on this issue? And that, of course, is so much more persuasive and compelling than either yelling from behind a screen or just trying to do some routine script that just feels completely unnatural.
Well, what sent you on this journey to sort of get a sense of who is trying to use that political action for power? Some of the people that you profile in the book, what started you on this path?
You know, I first came from this looking at the hobbyists, right? So I was trying to take a look at all of the ways that people do politics today. And I had this realization that they're doing this thing that looks more like a hobby than it does politics. And I started writing about that, but I realized that it's a real bummer to read. You know, it's depressing and awful to hear that so many of us are wasting hours a day not really channeling our values into concrete action. And so I wanted to see, well, what's the opposite of that? And I can't tell you how inspiring it was to like meet some organizers who from very different walks of life. I mean, there are people in the book who are 19 and 98. And what was really gratifying is that I don't take myself to be an activist. I don't come from that world. But I actually saw so much more in common. I felt I had so much more in common with people who are organizers and activists than I imagined. And it's because they're not yelling and screaming and protesting. They're, you know, they're really like building relationships. And that really, you know, I related to that.
Well, let's talk about some of the ones that you profile in the book. One is the Dems of North Mecklenburg, which is actually a precinct Democratic group, right?
Yeah, so this is an interesting situation. This was in Davidson, North Carolina, and there's a student there named Drew. And Drew noticed that the college Democratic club in his college, you know, didn't do very much. They kind of did their own little insular stuff on campus, like they hosted debates or discussions or movie nights. And actually, that's the same diagnosis for what was happening in a lot of like county Democratic Party committees. And this is true for Republican Party committees too, which is they're kind of insular. They'll have, you know, like a pancake breakfast, but they don't really do anything. And so Drew decided to start a committee, a precinct committee, that was really a joint effort between students at this college and community members in Davidson. And because the students were involved in the leadership of this, they were really, like, they really bought in. They were, like, part of the group. They weren't just kind of, warm bodies to help some grown-up group. They were really at the helm. And the community members embraced it. You know, they were excited about the fact that there was this collaboration. So you have retirees and students actually doing stuff together. And they did amazing work. I mean, fundraisers and canvases and working on policy issues. And, you know, a group in a precinct was having, like, you know, a 700-person event, which is just, like, completely unheard of. And I think that story holds a lot of lessons, particularly about not just students getting involved off campus, but this just really unusual thing, which is intergenerational civic group. And the secret to that is not such a surprising secret, but the secret is you let kids, college students, high school students, be part of the leadership. And it's really an amazing lesson.
Well, of course, they were filling a vacuum, really, because the precinct groups were probably moribund for the most part in that area. I would think most precinct groups around the country now are, that's a thing of the past almost.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, part of the book's story is about why has that happened? Why is it true that Democratic and Republican local committees are so weak? They do so little. They're mostly retirees who kind of wait around for a state convention to attend, and that's kind of it. And there's reason for that, which is that over time, the political parties nationally and also the government has disempowered local party committees. But there are groups that I studied, North Carolina, Oregon, where they figured out a way to do something real, and that, you know, was the result of a few people, not that many people, a few people having a vision and putting in a lot of time and effort.
So how does the party hierarchy react to this upstart precinct group that is actually mobilizing and, you know, doing what a precinct group is supposed to do?
I mean, they love it. You know,
oh, okay.
Drew is now, you know, he just graduated college, but he was, you know, on the governor of North Carolina's Christmas party list and, you know, giving talks to others about how they can replicate it. It's really been transformative. And it takes, you know, people in every community to move away from spending their time on politics, like following Washington and saying, you know, we have a role to play here.
Now, this is a Democratic group in a somewhat red state of North Carolina. Davidson is actually a Democratic center for the party. But how do they practically affect elections and getting power?
Yeah, I mean, so they, you know, see a strong connection between what happens locally and what happens nationally. You know, so Davidson is a liberal town, but it's in this very conservative area of Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. And so, like, the state representatives, for example, are Republicans. And even the Democratic Party said, you know, we can't really invest in some of these races. We can't beat the Republicans in this area. And Drew and the Precinct 206 Dems, they said, oh, I think we can. And they worked with this candidate who was, you know, really working hard, and they did fundraisers for her. And they showed that she was a viable candidate because they raised a lot of, you know, it's interesting. The state party had a kind of a ranking system. Should we invest in these candidates or not? And the candidate in their area was kind of didn't meet the threshold. And the way to prove that she was above the threshold is they got a lot of low-dollar donors to support her, and they got a lot of canvassers to support her. And soon enough, the state party realized, hey, maybe this is a viable race after all. They ended up throwing in like $600,000 to the state representative race. And the Democratic candidate there won by, you know, 300 votes in a really Republican area. So, you know, that person who's now going to the state legislature is going to vote on the Democratic side, obviously, for issues like, you know, voting rights, voter ID, gerrymandering, stuff like that, that has both local and national implications.
My guest today is Eitan Hirsch. He's an associate professor of political science at Tufts University and the author of Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. Well, contrasting with the Dems of North Mecklenburg, let's talk about the Russians of Brighton. And I believe it's Nak Vysotsky. I may have the name wrong there, but he is a Ukrainian who reminds me so much of like a figure out of the 19th century. Somebody who's taking care of his community, helping his community, and in return, people come to him and say, who should I vote for? And he lets them know.
That's right. It's really, his story is just amazing. And you know, at first I was like nervous about talking to him because all I knew was that he was called the Ukrainian boss and he controlled 1,000 votes. I heard he had been under investigation once by the U.S. attorneys. I couldn't quite figure this person out, so I wanted to meet him. And the story is just as you said, it's remarkable. I mean, he was just kind of a do-gooder in his community, driving people to doctor's appointments, helping people fill out forms. And then in the 90s, when he was already retired, there was this law, that a welfare reform bill in D.C. that President Clinton signed that initially was going to take benefits away from even from legal immigrants living in nursing homes. Like, they couldn't get food stamps anymore. And this was really disheartening to Nach and his community because they were, you know, low-income refugees, and they couldn't really work. And so not only did he start advocating, but he and his wife, they helped 300 of their neighbors get citizenship, you know, study for the test, you know, answer the questions. And so they all got citizenship. And then he started with his friends, who he called his lieutenants. They would go with a slate of candidates and tell everyone, you know, here's who supports our community. And sure enough, like within a couple of years, they had 2 or 3 times the voting rates of any of the precincts around them. And the story is amazing because, you know, he did this by just being nice, essentially, by contributing to his community. And in return, his neighbors, you know, trusted him to make good recommendations about voting. It's something that seems, on the one hand, like old school and like a machine form of politics, but also seems like completely accessible. Like, I could picture myself doing that in retirement.
It's sort of bread and butter issues, like he's working with a state legislator, or maybe it was even city council, I can't remember now, who is like, hey, we need to get these sidewalks clear. You know, we have lots of snow. The city's not cleaning the sidewalks. And he reaches out to a political person and says, hey, and you know, the political person responds by getting his staff out there to shovel sidewalks. I mean, it's that sort of relationship.
That's right. The state legislative staff was out there with their shovels. And, you know, that's what's important there is that the community was built, you know, they were first mobilized around immigration issues. And, yeah, you know, day to day, they cared a lot about, like, being able to walk to the train stop or the bus stop. And so they cared about shoveling. But, you know, when they cared about big issues like immigration, they were organized for that, too. You know, I have to tell you the epilogue to the story. After the book was finished, after I spent a bunch of time with this man who was 98, he passed away just a couple months ago, right before New Year's Eve. And I went to his funeral, and, you know, when a 99-year-old person dies, like, they don't usually have a lot of people in attendance at their funeral. And there may be 50 there, people there from the community, but in the front row, just sitting quietly, was the mayor of Boston, the governor of Massachusetts, state legislators and city councilors. And, you know, none of them were there to take a selfie or anything like that. They were there to pay their tribute, to honor this person who did this thing that is, like, is amazing, but also, you know, accessible.
Now, in a national election, 3 times the turnout, and maybe that doesn't add up to 3 times the turnout, but in local races, in statewide races, does that make a big difference?
It makes a huge difference. I mean, it makes a huge difference because no one controls that many votes. It's a very unusual thing to do. And the whole thing about this book, I think, is shifting to a paradigm in which, like, each person is not important. They're just, you know, a tiny drop in the bucket of, you know, 200 million person country. To thinking the way all the organizers think, which is, individually, I only have 1 vote I'm entitled to, but, you know, how many more can I get? How many more can I get by building trust? And this guy got 1,000, and that makes a difference when added to all the other people who have, you know, influence over their neighbors. And, you know, that's how politics works. So the reason why, you know, I give an example in the book in Massachusetts of party politics going up and down, you know, the Democrats did really well in the 2008 election when Barack Obama was on the ballot. And then in 2010, all across the country, the Democrats did poorly, including in Massachusetts, a blue state that, you know, had then a Republican senator all of a sudden because the Democrats stayed home. And a lot of that is because people don't have leaders like Nach who help them vote even in the down times, you know, even when the candidate's not great or, you know, politics, the wind's not, you know, not at your back anymore. All the people in Knox community still voted because they didn't vote based on who the candidates were at the national level or the gossip going on in Washington. They voted because they trusted their friend. And that's really, I think, an important lesson for how people can be engaged in politics. We need to build relationships with one another so that you can kind of be steady through the downtime.
I'm sure you ask a number of national political leaders, why aren't they trying to replicate people like NOC and the Dems of North Mecklenburg or the Voice of Westmoreland, which is another group in Western Pennsylvania you profile? And I remember one of your sources said, our parties are all top down. We come up with the policies and we sell them down the line. This type of organizing is bottom up. It would require a complete change in how the parties do business and how they come up with their positions and how they work.
That's right. Parties want control and they don't want anyone to embarrass them. And so, you know, if you had 1,000 people like this guy, like NOC around, some of them might go rogue. Some of them might be, you know, occasionally some of them might be bad and, you know, and embarrass the party. And I think that people who don't really believe in the grassroots bottom-up model say, like, I'm just not willing to make that trade-off of having local leaders who have their own coalitions, who have their own network. I want all that to be centered in me, in my national campaign, that I control the email list, and I control everything. And I just think that's the wrong model.
One of the things you also talk about in the book is it's not just mainline parties that benefit from these sorts of organizers that choose one of the two main parties. You have also extremist groups looking at this model. You write about KKK members that are offering help to opioid addicts. And outside of the United States, groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Muslim Brotherhood, they flourish because they provide all sorts of services like health and education. They show that they care about those people and then only ask at voting time or protest time, be there for us. So it's not necessarily just mainstream groups that are looking at this technique. It's extremist groups as well.
Well, I think it's mostly the extremist group. I mean, mainstream groups think that, you know, and you can see this in the Democratic primary right now, they think that they're going to get votes by selling big ideas and say, hey, we have some big plan that's going to help people maybe in 10 years if something gets passed by Congress, which will never happen. Meanwhile, you have groups on the far left and the far right that are saying, forget all that. We're not going to talk to you about ideology, but what we will do is, we'll have an opioid clinic for you, or we'll, you know, help with babysitting. And if only the groups on the far extremes are doing that kind of real work that builds rapport and trust, then the mainstream parties are going to have to look at politics getting more extreme and wondering why.
Well, do you have a prescription for how the parties need to change their viewpoints, how to encourage more of groups like the Voice of Westmoreland, which we really haven't talked about, which is a group of, I think it was suburban mothers who started making an influence in Western Pennsylvania, the Dems of North Mecklenburg, and individuals like NOC. What is the prescription for the parties?
Well, the first is, you know, the book is much more focused on the prescriptions for the individual, and that's because I think a lot of people who don't like what's going on in politics, their first reaction is like, who is to blame for this that's not me? And they look to money in politics and gerrymandering in the Electoral College, and they can tick off for you all of these things that are, this is why things are bad. It's not me. It's this other stuff. And I want this book to be a message to the reader saying, like, hey, let's take this journey that helps us reflect more on what our values are and how we are channeling them into action. And if we're only channeling them to hobbyism, maybe we need to make a change if we really care about what's going on in our communities and our country. But yeah, I think the political parties also have to do stuff. I mean, you see right now, I think the difference between, say, like rich funders like the Kochs on the right versus rich funders like Steyer and Bloomberg on the left, this is an example of what to do and what not to do. So the Kochs have been very good about long-term party building. You know, you invest in a county judge at age 25 so that maybe in 30 years that person could be on the Supreme Court. You invest in state legislatures so that they can, you know, take your side on redistricting. Meanwhile, on the left, you have these examples of billionaires spending $400 million on their vanity projects. And that's a mistake. They, if they really believe in their values, then they need to take a kind of a slow and steady grassroots approach, building rapport in communities, getting a farm team of local leaders, including younger leaders, and working from the bottom up. So, I think there's a lot of things that the political parties can do, investing money not in sort of like some lottery ticket of an idea that, you know, if this works, then we can finally solve all our problems. Like, politics is not like that. You got to kind of take a slow and steady approach. And right now, I think that's much more prevalent of an approach on the Republican side than the Democratic side. So I think they're likely to do well for a while.
Mm. You write in the book at the very end, it says, could you imagine like a political party opening up a daycare center or doing these sort of really grassroots efforts to help people and in turn create an atmosphere where they're not only open to voting for you, they're advocates for voting for you.
That's right. Yeah, I take this example from my own employer, Tufts University, which has an emergency child care and elder care program. You know, if a faculty or staff needs emergency backup care for kids or for elderly parents, the employer subsidizes them. And that's what a political party could do. And why would they do that? Well, they have, both parties have values related to supporting families, and they have big ideas about how they want to do that. I mean, the Democrats want to pass some big, you know, paid family leave program, and they want to do that. And, you know, real kind of good quality elder care and child care is kind of a long way away. So what could a party do to convey that it really values this now? Well, maybe instead of spending billions of dollars on ads, it can say, hey, you know, are you in a tough place? Do you need a backup child care provider? We, the state party, the local party, we can help you through that and can show you really concretely that we understand the struggles that families have with kids and with elderly parents, and we're there to help. So why don't parties do that right now? Because it's hard. It's messier, and it's completely outside of the framework of what they're doing, which is, you know, just ads after ads after ads.
But at one point in our history, parties tended to do things like that.
That's right. Yeah, we have this history of party machines, particularly in cities, that would do stuff like, of course, everyone knows kind of passing out free turkeys and things like that, but vaccine shots, you know, cash assistance. And a lot of that is wrapped up in people's minds as really a kind of a bad, dangerous form or corrupt form of politics. And that's because party machines were at times quite corrupt, racist. They, you know, this wasn't like a golden age, but some of those things that the party machines did very well, I think we could learn from.
Well, the prescription for an individual, is it first thing is find an issue you really care deeply about and then become engaged beyond just sitting on the couch and consuming news?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who are in this, you know, the book is not targeted at someone who doesn't care at all about politics. I'm talking to the people who are spending time and energy and emotion on politics, but not channeling into anything. I think a lot of those people already have an issue or a candidate or a party that they care about. And so the question is, what can they do to increase the power of their vote? You know, how many people in their own community do they have in them to influence? Can they get 10? Can they get 100? Can they get 1,000 like Nah? You know, and that requires maybe being part of a community or building a community around this goal. It requires learning about local issues and candidates. But it mainly requires shifting both the paradigm of what your job is in politics as a consumer, or is it as someone who's a real engaged political person. And then, you know, spend the 2 hours that you're now spending toggling over to Facebook and Twitter to learn what's going on in your own community.
Eitan Hersh is an associate professor of political science at Tufts University and the author of Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.